Here We Go, the Downward Facing Spiritual Spiral podcast. My name, of course, is Eddie Cohn. I'm the host, creator of the Spiritual Spiral. Thank you so much for listening, choosing this show to listen to. I appreciate it. Got a really good conversation in store for you today. Speaking to Matt Belinsky. He's an attorney here based in Los Angeles. But I became intrigued with Matt through actually Twitter. I found out about him on Twitter. He's sort of become, over the last year or so, he's been intrigued with tech and the media and how they're manipulating you. And he's become even more interested in sort of how COVID has reshaped our culture. And I think that's obviously been a topic that has interested me. You know, this show sort of started out talking about how social media is impacting the world, but I think COVID and tech and the media is sort of lumped into one group right now. So when I went online and checked out Matt and sort of saw what he's about on Instagram and Twitter, I wanted to talk to him because I'm really intrigued with people right now, or I'm intrigued by people who aren't making things political. I think it is so impossible to find people that don't get emotional or inflammatory or want to make things political or want to point fingers or claim to have the answers. I'm troubled by the world that we live in right now. I think, and I say this in the conversation with Matt, I feel like it's important to ask questions. A journalist's job is to ask challenging questions. And it feels like they have stopped asking questions and are just pointing fingers, grandstanding, pretending to have the answers, judging other people, putting other people down. And I'm pretty distraught by what's going on right now. And so I'm enjoying conversations with people that are looking at different angles and trying to be objective. You know, a friend of mine, before you listen to the conversation, really quickly, a friend of mine sent me a video a couple days ago at Trader Joe's, where this group of about 8 to 10 people are walking into Trader Joe's without a mask on, claiming to reclaim their freedom. And I can see where they're frustrated by what's going on right now. Of course, I think that these blanket statements of just everybody wear a mask, everybody stay at home, I think is actually creating more harm than good. I think it's causing so much distrust, isolation, more depression, more suicide. But anyway, this video that she sent me, so these people invade Trader Joe's, and they're clearly, you know, instigators. But then I'm looking at the employees and the people pointing fingers and yelling at them, and people are scared of them because they're walking into the store without a mask. And I just think the whole thing, the whole story, the whole escapade is just really sad that this is what our world has turned into. And I don't know how we are going to get out of this mess. And it feels to me like some very powerful people or groups of people or pharmaceutical companies or representatives from the government or China have used this COVID situation and found an opportunity to manipulate people, to scare people, to get people to sort of act like animals. And I think we need to have these challenging conversations because the information we're getting, I don't know what to believe anymore. I think Matt also has noticed clearly what has been going on and something just doesn't feel right. And he's taking a stance and he's using social media and Instagram to point out these strange, false narratives that are being pushed by the media. I think he's using Instagram, using social media to ask questions that the media isn't asking. And that's what's really disturbing right now. So reached out to Matt about a week or two ago, and he said yes to being on my show. So of course, I'm stoked that he took the time to talk to me. You can find Matt on Instagram at Matt Belinsky. He's also on Twitter. And again, I think we just need to go a little bit below the surface. I think he brings up a lot of interesting points. And I think he shares a lot of questions and posts that, you know, got me thinking. It's just this world that we live in right now is really difficult to navigate. So as always, if you enjoy the show, please head over to iTunes. That stuff really helps. Head over there and give it a review. Give it a 5-star review. Maybe share the show with your friends. You can find Matt on Instagram, as I said, at Matt Belinsky. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, at Eddie Cohn. Website is iameddiecohn.com. I have a bunch of new music that's out, so you can find me on Spotify. So that is it. As always, thank you so much for listening and supporting and being a part of the Downward Facing Spiritual Spiral podcast. Well, first of all, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I was thinking about a lot of stuff, but I guess first, before I ask you some questions that sort of go into society and sort of where we're at now, just give me a little background on what you're doing, and which will then sort of lead into my question, but maybe it sort of is answering itself, because I suddenly thought about law and this idea of finding the truth and influencing. So then I kind of think to myself, well, maybe there is an obvious parallel towards your interest of sort of what's going on presently in this sort of day and age right now. But just give me your background and how you got into law and what you do now.
Sure. I went to law school at UCLA back in the early and mid 2000s. And it was a different era back then. You still had the entertainment industry. Although the internet was still around and digital content was still had kind of gotten out of the gates, it was still very much an analog world, and traditional film and television dominated. And that's where I thought I wanted to aim with my career. And then within a year and a half of being out into the workforce, it's kind of slammed with a lot of reality. One with the Great Recession, first company that I worked for, I was an entertainment lawyer with a pretty successful film production company, and they started downsizing, you know, in mid-2008. I started to see some of the social media platforms take off as real businesses. And, you know, from 2008 through the Great Recession, because I had not really gotten established anywhere, I mean, I was just trying to find my way.
Yeah.
And a couple things perked my ears up about the digital world through, you know, somewhat serendipitous contact with a guy who had been a little older than me in high school, and a friend's older brother's friend who had an up-and-coming social media company. I kind of got into the digital world a bit and started, you know, liked what I saw, but I didn't really cut the cord on law and just dive into a startup. It was a different environment back then. It was a lot more feast or famine. It was really either the handful of companies that had reached, you know, broader consciousness or IPO'd, and there wasn't this kind of massive, the massive shift of American commerce to the digital sphere hadn't yet occurred. It was still very selective. So, you know, I kept keeping a foot in the water on the startup side, but developing, you know, a legal practice and clients across a couple different industries. That led to some deeper involvement with a digital streaming platform called Pluto TV that I was kind of part-time general counsel for and advisor for. And for maybe 3 or 4 years, I kind of twin track just having my legal practice with a boutique law firm and working with Pluto. And that went through early 2019. Pluto had a very successful exit to Viacom.
Right.
And then in terms of me as a kind of social media commentator, it's something I just did instinctually and out of desire.
Where did that interest towards what you just said about social media and being a commentator, do you remember when did that sort of perk your interest, and when you felt like you should dive into that and talk about it?
I mean, for years, I felt like something that I liked doing, even from a very incredibly crude, immature blog that I started doing when I was out of work in 2009, to just always a very active Facebook participant, you know, and then it becoming a bit more active Twitter and Instagram participant. I don't really do Facebook anymore. And yeah, I was someone that everyone said for 8 years, you should have a podcast since podcasts began. Right. But because I didn't really have a topic, and I was a generalist, and a lot of my worldview had not really come into focus yet, And also I was lazy. I never really did it. Then, you know, 2016, 17, I think I really accelerated my understanding of the universe and particularly the digital communication ecosystem, and came to a number of conclusions that have definitely informed my worldview a lot over the past 4 to 5 years, very much right now, in terms of, you know, and how institutional media no longer reflects is more so about groupthink and tribalism and manufacturing a narrative than it is about traditional journalistic ethics. And a variety, I could riff on that for a while, right?
Well, what's interesting though, I just read an article, Yancey Stickler, he founded Kickstarter, and he's got a blog and he wrote a book, and I find his writing interesting. And he was speaking to somebody who's a journalist, and one of the first things she said was, as a journalist, I love to ask questions. And I thought to myself, that's kind of how I like to live my life, with curiosity and asking questions, and I'm not a journalist. But it feels like the landscape of journalism is no longer asking questions, but it's about forcing opinions, and then if they don't agree with you, just tear the other person down.
That, and also protecting the journalistic class as a social group.
What does that mean? What do you mean?
That the cohort of people that are journalists at a variety of similar publications and espouse a certain worldview are about protecting the reputations and narratives built by those people regardless. That they are not professional colleagues trying to hold each other accountable, but they are members of a team that if attacked, regardless of the validity of the attack, will come to aid.
Yeah. And I think there's something complicated that happened that I've been trying to sort of unspool. And I you know, I'm a musician, podcaster, yoga teacher, and I realize the value of social media. But I think there's two things that are happening here. I think social media is creating brains that don't think objectively because it's causing people to not have an attention span and, you know, the scrolling action. People aren't objectively thinking for yourself. And I think millions of people, and that number is growing more and more exponentially every day. And so I almost feel like leaders of the media, CNN, Fox, New York Times, they are changing the way that they report and they care more about the headline to get your attention. And I also feel like they're not Dan Rather, Peter Jennings. They are really like TMZ. I watch Cuomo on CNN, and these guys are great communicators. I mean, I think they're terrible journalists, but they're amazing communicators.
There's something to be said for that. I mean, because I see through their bullshit, I don't consider them such great communicators, but I could see how somebody would. Cable news expanded to 24 hours. You had multiple stations that were going 24 hours and thus needed 24 hours of content to fill the space. They all slowly but surely, incrementally became more sensationalistic and needed to continue to keep the hype going. Concurrently disregarded and dismissed a variety of ethics that suggested that they should be more, that there should be objective. And, you know, Fox, the media was liberally slanted, but I don't think was troublingly so in the 90s and early 2000s. But regardless of that, Fox News came along and said, nobody is serving a more right-wing audience, so we're going to serve that audience. And that's nothing wrong with that in principle, but they definitely overserved. And I do think they initially threw journalistic principles out the window during, you know, the Bush administration. And then slowly but surely that created a boomerang effect with CNN and MSNBC and a lot of the other, you know, non-conservative. Like, listen, although you'd never get Fox News to blatantly admit it, everyone knows, hey, we're here to provide the counter narrative and to serve the right wing audience. And when they were the only ones that were prejudicial and the other outlets were more objective, then you couldn't really excuse that. Then when all the other outlets also become very subjective and slanted, well, then it's, at least Fox News is being honest about it. At least Fox News is like, no one's under any illusions that, hey, they're there to provide the kind of blatant, the standard right-wing narrative. Now, when you're sitting around with CNN and just clearly clickbait, the broadcast version of clickbait and tabloid-esque in trying to present a certain narrative, and they are going to still hide behind the veneer of objectivity. And it's bullshit, of course. No one's even questioning. No, I mean, you have to be a real, really have your head in the sand at this point. And then with the death of the monoculture and the just fragmentation of media and of audiences, everyone starts, they start being governed by desperation, and they become more desperate to keep audience. And in this day and age, you keep audience better by not offending your audience. And sometimes, and that means not providing truths that might alienate them. And I see this happen on social media all the time. And it took me gathering a bit of a larger following to understand how this works. It's like, wow, people know how they got followings. You got, most people gathered a following and acquired a larger audience by serving one narrative. And people are concerned, and rightfully so, from a purely tactical perspective, in alienating those audiences. Ethically, it shouldn't be a concern. Ethically, you should present the truth. But tactically, in terms of keeping an audience, it's better if you just give them what they want. And if it's something that you think is going to alienate people, don't give them that.
So many angles. I just, I'm a musician. I'm rereading this Bruce Springsteen book, and I read something today where he writes, "The new world is a world of black and white, a place of freedom where the two most culturally powerful tribes in American society find common ground, pleasure, and joy in each other's presence." And, you know, it's funny. I think there's such major tech addiction, and the irony now with COVID, everybody's even more isolated and addicted to their tech, and they're addicted to this world that you're talking about, where they're just being fed information that puts them at ease, that sort of reinforces what they already think. And yeah. I know I probably sound a little negative, glass half empty here, but I've seen this and watch the world, and I read the news.
Negativity is justified.
I'm pretty happy, and I live a good life, and I realize I'm lucky. But when I really examine and think what's going on, and I'm trying to navigate this as an artist, as a musician, I think it is a uphill battle, and it's really hard to offer different perspectives because I just feel like people don't know how to listen. They don't know how to understand it. Even I went to the doctor just for a physical 2 days ago, and everything was fine. But he said something like, he said, just wear a mask. He says, I don't mean to be political here, but just wear a mask. And I didn't go there, but because I just didn't want to go down that route. But I think to myself, I see why people want to wear a mask. But I can also see why people don't want to wear a mask and think that this is a bit strange when Fauci's saying, wear one mask, wear two masks.
Also, you know, where you wear a mask.
Right.
Like, I can certainly see the case for wearing a mask when interacting, when congregating with a number of individuals together for a sustained amount of time.
Yes.
The efficacy of wearing a mask. Don't tell me there's any benefit to me being forced to put on a mask to walk into a restaurant to sit down, then take the mask off. Don't tell me that. Stop telling me that, because it's bullshit and because only an incredibly juvenile mind could actually believe that. And so instead, you've got all these people and this really large set of aspect of society now that is complete theater that no one believes it. that everyone knows instinctually and both subconsciously and consciously is ridiculous, but is some, for some reason, a necessity, right?
Yeah.
And we're getting really used to that. And that is something that I'm concerned about, because eventually this is going to have to end, right? So what, you know, we've seen differences and changes and modifications in COVID restrictions within certain boundaries, right? Like in LA, outdoor dining being opened up, or some, you know, larger public spaces, or this or that or whatever. But there's stuff that doesn't seem to change in terms of, businesses requiring you to put on a mask if you're indoors or you're, you know, walking through a hallway or God knows what, or even in my building, right? I live in a condo building in LA, and technically, like, yeah, I'm supposed to wear a mask in the elevator or in the lobby. And what is going to happen? What is going to be the catalyst, the triggering factor that causes the powers that be to say, okay, no longer are you required to wear a mask in the elevator or in the hallways? And that's weird to contemplate, right? Because, like, I don't, you know, COVID numbers are slipping down. Let's be honest. I'm calling it right now. In 6 to 8 weeks, COVID numbers are going to be super low. And so at that time, what is the HOA or the administration of a variety of different restaurants, are they going to sit there and they go, okay, now in the city of Los Angeles, this, the 7-day moving average is 1,200 cases of tracked positive cases of COVID, 12 people died per day, and there are 400 people hospitalized who we believe are hospitalized from COVID. And that, well, to be perfectly honest, those numbers are very, very low. So are they going to say at that point, you know something, it no longer makes sense to require people to take this precaution and this inconvenience in our building, in the space that we have authority over? So I think there's going to be a lot of conflict there. There's a lot of tension there. And then when do you, the restrictions that have not been loosened the entire time, like when are those going to be loosened?
Yeah. And I don't think there's anybody out there that's adding sort of, that's trying to relax the culture. I think to your point, I do believe even if somebody says, oh, you don't have to wear a mask in an apartment building, so much anxiety has been promulgated by the media and Fauci and just the world that there are going to be all these sort of individual attacks where people may see you not wearing a mask and start yelling at you. And I feel like there's going to be all these stories every day of people getting into fights because some people are still obsessed about the mask, other people don't. And then I just think, yeah, I think it's going to get ugly.
Yeah, and it's just created this ubiquitous tension between people.
Yeah.
Right? There's when I even go from, they stopped a valet service at my building. And I was like, you serious? Like the valet and the driver, the whole idea of valet is you're not in the same fucking car at the same time. Like the chances of anyone getting COVID in that manner is pretty much zero. So now I have to go park in my car and then walk into the lobby in the elevator. Sometimes you forget a mask, right? And I might not have a mask. And I got to sit there and have anxiety, you know, or concern that I'm going to go into the elevator and there's going to be someone there and they're going to, you know, bitch or moan about me not wearing a mask. And like the actual chances of, well, first of all, no one knows that I already got COVID. I can't transfer. I'm sorry. The available evidence says at least for 9 months to a year, if you got it, you don't get it again and you can't transfer it. Because I've been around a lot of people over the past 7 months since I got COVID. I got in June. Nobody's got it from me. And I've been around a ton of people who didn't get it. And I didn't get it again. Like there's about 8 people that I was with over the New Year's holiday who got it in Miami and I did not get it. So like, no, I can't fucking get it again.
Yeah.
At least for this amount of time. So they don't know that I can. They don't know that I pose zero risk. And the fact that no, there's zero chance that if me and you pass each other in an elevator for a, you know, a 2.3 seconds or less, that you're going to get COVID from me or that I'm going to get COVID from you. So it's just whether or not the person that you happen to land on is someone who's been infested with COVID anxiety. And the COVID anxiety, I say, is not to suggest that nobody should have any anxiety about COVID, but there's some people who understand where the COVID risk comes from and don't. Like, if you're a person who is concerned that if you go to a dinner and sit at a table or go give a car ride to someone for 20 minutes and you both are sitting in the car with windows up without a mask, like, that's something you should be concerned about getting COVID from.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Walking past someone, you should have no concern. None. In terms of, you know, am I going to get a severe case of COVID that may land me in intensive care or kill me? If you're 60 or 65 and up, or someone who has diabetes, heart disease, obese, you're someone who is rightfully concerned about severe or potentially fatal COVID results. If you're someone who is young, generally thin, and doesn't have a pre-existing condition, you should not really lose a goddamn second of sleep. Oh, maybe you don't want to get COVID because you don't want to get sick. Sure, nobody right. wants to get sick. But you should not be losing any sleep over, you know, you should be, the extent to which you should be altering your life in that, if you fall in that category, I don't think should be high. If you're 67 and overweight, you should be altering your lifestyle significantly. You should be staying at home.
Yeah, and it's funny, I a couple more points here before I think about something else, but I'm a germaphobe. You know, I'm also, I used to have a lot of health issues as a kid, and I'm a bit hypochondriacal. It's funny, ironically, I just don't think it's smart for people to stay home, isolate themselves. I have a friend who needs knee surgery. She's got a terrible limp, and she can't have that surgery done because of COVID right now, because she's not considered top priority. So for the last year, her pain's getting worse and worse. She's getting more depressed. Her immune system's going to go down. And then ultimately, then she may be more likely sure. to get COVID. Sure. I think the way that the world, I just get pissed off that we as a culture, we as the media, as the United States, allowed the handling of this to go on this way, just these blanket statements where all of you stay home, all of you wear a mask. And this, to your point, people over the 65, stay home, wear a mask. Everybody, I have friends in their late 20s who have like those visors on and are wearing two masks. I'm thinking to myself, you're insane.
You're insane. Yeah, there's a higher chance that you get struck by lightning than get die of COVID.
Yes, completely.
Like I think a lot of it is cinematic, and people still think any pandemic, any virus that is considered a pandemic is this crazy indiscriminate thing whoever it get infects have these fatal, like something like Ebola, right? I mean, from what I'm, you know, not that I'm an Ebola expert, but I've done some research and just like Ebola can kill you no matter who you are. Like COVID, it is pretty damn clear. It is highly, highly, highly concentrated in certain categories. So it's people who either can acknowledge that information and absorb that information and govern themselves accordingly or not, right? And that's where I think we got tripped up. And then it became this moral thing, this ethical thing,
yeah.
and this bifurcated thing. And, you know, and it started, I mean, it's weird now to look now, okay, we're about, you know, for him not being, I'll say the end of Donald Trump's presidency was January 6th, right? We're a little over a month since the end of his presidency. He hasn't been a factor in our lives. So, all right, now we don't have that really divisive, it's not quite as divisive, or it's divisive in another way. But it happened while everyone was either, anything that you did that seemed to associate itself with a point of view expressed by Donald Trump was anathema to some people, and some people felt very defensive about that and opposed anything else. And it was crazy, right? And we lived like that. And now we're living kind of a diet version of that. And we'll see. It's too early for me to come to that many conclusions about it. We'll see where we're at.
Yeah, but you brought up, I don't know if this was intentional, but, you know, bringing up the hydroxychloroquine, Trump sort of laissez-faire attitude 10, 12 months ago about the virus. If anybody speaks like you and I do, they have made Trump out to be the devil, the worst human being on the face of the planet, the media. And anybody that shares your point of view, my point of view about the masks, and then they just lump us up in that group and then think that we're white supremacists and think that we're Republicans. And I will say the one thing that I think Trump did reveal is our reliance on China. And this, and I feel,
The two things that I always said, this is that I do not at all, I do not support his personal behavior, his ethics, or his demeanor. And I could think of more than a few people that I would prefer to be president, but Donald Trump was right on two issues, and it was China and the media. He exposed the media for the craven, lying, you know, tribalist charlatans they are. And he did finally say, wait a second, this country is a hostile force that has been waging a one-way war against us, and we now need to actually fight back. Those were the best parts of his presidency for about 3.5 years. That was some economic steps that he took that I think did benefit the working class and resulted in rising wages. I think that unfortunately over the past year, he threw it all away. I think on COVID, instead of trying to, he should have just accepted, and he did eventually, right? You could see when he just accepted, okay, this is a thing and this is scaring people. And this needs to be addressed. But he could, instead of it appearing that he was simply aggrieved and complaining that this virus had come along and ruined his beautiful economy, he should have been circling the wagons on China. And instead of kind of, I don't mind calling it the China virus. I don't see anything wrong with it. It came from fucking China.
Right.
However, instead of making cogent arguments about how this all validated his approach to China, that we need to bring manufacturing back, that they are sloppy, that they are irresponsible, that they are hostile. He could have done that. And instead, he totally lost that argument. He lost the plot on that completely. So that, plus how he conducted himself after the election with the attempts to fabricate stories about election fraud, and what occurred on January 6th, he threw it all away. Everything that the handful of things that I think that he did that were positive, I mean, pretty much threw it all away. Yeah. January 6th, like, validated everything. Every dishonest, deranged journalist who had no qualms about fabricating stories just to smear Trump and justified it all with, he is that dangerous, he is that much of a threat. Everything got validated by what he fucking did. And I think it's pretty incredible. I mean, it's still something I'm trying to absorb.
Here's one thing I'm not a Trump supporter. I'm a being objective supporter. If it weren't for the virus, Trump would be in the office right now. Would be better.
Oh, yeah.
So
as much as
if it weren't for the COVID, mail-in ballots wouldn't have happened. I think there was an interesting article that came out in Time last week where they're not saying there was voter fraud, but COVID certainly created the atmosphere or the environment where the media and mail-in ballots and the way that these stories were construed could certainly create a world where Biden's going to win. This whole past year certainly helped their cause for sure.
Without a doubt, it was Donald Trump. The problem with Donald Trump is tail risk. The tail risk of a black swan event that he is poorly suited for, and that's what happened. He was very poorly suited for this. It created an environment, you know. Well, I mean, we could unpack this dozens of layers, right?
But then I also think to myself, could any, like, what president could have handled this last year well?
I think he could have. No, I don't think it was that hard.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think he needed to, he should have accepted in February, he thought the Chinese were bluffing. He thought the Chinese were trying to spook everyone and spook him into taking steps to ruin the economy. Hmm. And that he wanted the economy to be his golden, his toy and his Fabergé egg to present in his case for re-election. And so he dismissed it and he rolled the dice. He could have made the other bet and said, listen, this is dangerous. We're going to have to take steps to close the economy. It's going to hurt people. We're going to find ways to provide support, but it's China's fault. China.
Yeah.
He should have done that. He would have won. He would have won the election.
It's funny. I think this goes back into my social media point. I feel like he has sort of become like Paris Hilton. You know, he's just like everybody else. We've suddenly became a world where dignity and truth don't matter anymore, and it's more about ego, seeming like you have the answers. The idea that Trump could say, oh, I could have handled that better, or apologize, or that type of behavior and action from people just seems to be going away. I feel like it's almost like I almost feel like it's the rage, the road rage antics, where as long as you have those windows up, behind the car, people feel like they can say and do anything. And it's very similar to social media. It's sort of like, instead of a dignified conversation, people act like assholes.
Yeah, it's a lot of that. And I still think that Donald Trump was more so the symptom of that rather than the cause, which is why I know we have to do that. I was not a Donald Trump supporter, and I wasn't a Donald Trump supporter, and I'm also not the supporter of any politician.
Right.
But I cut him more slack because I think he was a reaction to that. That he was a reaction to what you're describing, done by the elite ruling class of more college-educated, polished people. That included the media and a lot of our kind of cultural authorities, right? So I was like, all right, if it's insanity versus non-insanity, then I know my decision's easy. But if it's one version of insanity versus simply another more polished, well-spoken version of insanity, then I gotta run the comparison. I gotta run the pros and cons. And I think that's where a lot of people were like, hey, I'm pro objectivity. Like, you tell me that all these deaths are just on Donald Trump's head, I don't fucking believe you. You tell me that he colluded with the Russians to release all this information on Hillary Clinton and steal the election, I don't believe you, because you didn't present evidence that supports that. And all these other things that I'm not going to believe them just because they imply they have negative implications for Donald Trump. You have to tell me the truth. And they don't do that.
I want a couple more points and I'll let you go, but I want to talk a little bit more about the word influencer and sort of relate it. And I'll play a little devil's advocate here, because I know you and I seem to think similarly to what's going on, but I think the combination of, I just read the Chris Cornell biography, and I was listening to the Marc Maron podcast with Mike Campbell. He's from the Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about, being influenced by the Ramones and influenced by the Sex Pistols, or influenced by, Johnny Cash. Uh-huh. Somehow I feel like the word influencer has been turned into, influencing good behavior.
Well, I mean, listen, just like there are tons of different celebrities, some of whom you'd like and some of whom you didn't. How did a person become a celebrity previously? They were either an athlete, they were someone who was famous for being an actor, or a handful of the people who were put on television or wrote for magazines and newspapers, or musicians, right?
Sure.
And they gathered audience and interest from people through that activity. Now, the activity is being entertaining and or interesting on social media. And there are some people who do that and do it very admirably or virtuously, or at least entertainingly, and some people who don't. So I don't want to, use the term too broadly or imply anything about influencers, quote unquote, too broad.
Yeah, but what exactly, again, why should somebody pay attention or listen to you and your points about the culture and society as opposed to, you know, the New York Times or somebody who is actually, you know, a paid journalist?
It's you use consciousness and critical thinking.
Yeah.
Is your understanding of the world and your rational brain tell you that what I'm saying has validity, and does it resonate with you? And does it seem that I'm exhibiting admirable characteristics like acknowledging when I'm wrong, or dissecting an issue past the first layer, or speaking a truth that other people don't feel comfortable speaking? Are in my case, it's a lot of stuff that, from the feedback I've gotten, that we live in a time where people feel uncomfortable expressing basic truth that should not be controversial. And I express those. And because I'm not worried about being I don't think I'm that controversial. I certainly don't think I'm as controversial as the people who find me to be very controversial. But a lot of people say, no, you know, you're a little controversial, Matt, but really you're saying straightforward stuff that a lot of people are thinking but not saying.
Yeah.
And that's why, that from what I've gathered, that seems to be why a lot of people now listen to me. There's other people that people listen to for other stuff, for other reasons. I mean, you give me five people, I could try to describe, you know, why people listen to them.
But what's your sort of focus, or does it shift depending on what's going on culturally?
It shifts. I mean, that's I really try to reflect the times, and I try to stay fresh, and it's constantly shifting. It is still trying to provide the perspective on COVID, just as we described earlier. It's like, okay, you've got some people who want to really push the narrative that this was all a hoax. You've got some people who want to push the narrative that everyone needs to be locked in their house and freak the fuck out. And I'm kind of finding that space where, hey, this is not a hoax. This is something that needs to be addressed, and this does harm people, but it does not harm people in a manner that should necessarily be blanketing society and have everyone locked in their house and you afraid to lay eyes on or be in the same room as anybody else. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm not the only one trying to occupy that space, but there's not that many people trying to occupy that space. And in mainstream media, there's not that many people trying to occupy that space. Right? So that's why some people look to me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny. I struggle with social media because it does something to my brain, and I don't quite know what it is yet. It's almost like Las Vegas, and I like my quiet time. I'm writing a book. I'm doing music. Podcast is certainly creative, and you know, I'll jump on there to promote a song or something. But I don't know. I have a hard time navigating it. Do you feel like you're addicted to it? Do you have a hard time navigating
I'm probably addicted to it, but I mean, I don't just consider social media this novelty. Social media is just, this is how I communicate. Yeah. Here's a way for me to express things, and that whatever I express reaches a lot of people, or a way for me to research or find things. Or if it's talking Instagram, a way to date, right?
Yeah.
You know, I could imagine that I probably would be a little more successful and make more money in my day-to-day career if I never got on Twitter, never got on Instagram, but that's not going to happen. And how I monetize this or find opportunity from the following that I have created, I don't know. We'll have to see. I think it's benefited me in a number. I definitely think it's been a net plus in my life. And how I formalize my involvement in it is I'm still working out right now. But I think at this point, just accept social media in your life as much as accepting that you were going to shake hands before. That's part of your life.
Yeah. I for whatever reason, I don't like this idea. I mean, look, you know, you responded to my message. So if it weren't for social media, I wouldn't have reached out and we wouldn't have this conversation right now. But there is something about this idea where anybody can say anything. I don't know. And again, I'm not anti-free speech, but I think that's actually maybe not a good thing.
It's not, but it's a reality and it's not going to change.
Right. Yeah.
So we need to navigate that. That's why I'm a free speech proponent, because I know, I understand that, and I acknowledge the fact that there's going to be just a fucking ocean of incorrect opinions out there and incorrect facts and statements and whatnot. And everyone, so in knowing, in understanding that that's the case, and that there's no one who's really equipped, no central source that's equipped to determine fact, we have to just accept that that's part of it. So we need to elevate, well, we need to elevate the people who are willing to encounter all the opinions and dissect them most sensibly and mindfully. And that, but still allow everyone to say it, right? Because if not, let's be honest, like, no, the censorship regime is completely asymmetrical. And if you express anything that's even mildly right-wing and can be shown to not be 100% true, you could get censored. And if you espouse the most blatant lie and you're part of the left-wing media infrastructure, you get away with it. Like, yeah. That's a reality. Anyone who can look at what's going on and not acknowledge that as a truth, you're lying, right? So is that okay? Does that excuse the right-wing lies? No, but it's just accept, like, you have to keep consistent. There has to be some consistency. Where it's not ethical. It's not acceptable for society to be that prejudicial in one direction or the other to the information, to which set of lies and which set of truths it accepts or rejects.
What do you think about my thesis that social media and Instagram are ruining the world? And I really
it's too broad.
Well, let me make it more specific. It's creating narcissism and more self-absorption. It's numbing people's brains. It's creating more of this tribalistic behavior. Instead of having conversations and face-to-face conversations and reading and educating themselves, people in their free time are primarily scrolling and addicted to their phones. And when you add all of that up, you've got a culture that is less objective, less intelligent, less thoughtful. And I don't see the positive outcome of all of this. I don't see it 20 years from now. And now, thanks to COVID, people are more addicted to the tech that I just speak of. People right now, instead of talking about the world and the issues in the world, care more about how many likes they got on their selfie from dinner 2 hours ago. And I think we're talking in the millions and millions, and it's only going to get worse.
I just see an inevitability. I see an inevitability to it all, right? I mean, it's not.
No, I mean, and I understand that, like, we can't.
This accelerates, this accentuates the capabilities and the positives for the people who, hey, it's easier for me to say because I do think I fall in the category of people who've benefited from this. It accentuates the benefits to those who use it well. And it is corrosive to a lot of people who aren't as capable.
Well, let's take it out of that benefits you, doesn't benefit somebody else. I mean, I see the benefits, of course, but I just think all the other intrinsic, subtle things that you can't really gauge and beyond.
But what was going to happen with the internet if this didn't happen?
You know, that's a great question, actually, because if you think
that, no, for real, like, I think chew on that one, because, like, you can't just say, well, the world would have been better without the internet.
Maybe it was the internet, email, but then at some point, maybe it's as simple as the smartphone and Instagram and Facebook. It feels like it sort of created. Where everybody then has the power to create sort of a certain persona and make themselves out to be a celebrity. I think you're right. Maybe the internet itself wasn't bad, but the adoption of the smartphone and social media?
Yeah, you could say that. In that case, a lot of people would also be stuck in super linear, slow growth careers and tracks that where you had to really get on one track, work your way up against the, you know, blast your way through those, the seniority ceilings, and kind of take a slow roll approach to life that a lot of people probably found dissatisfying, but found to be inevitable back then. And now a lot of people have been freed from that and found ways to navigate around that, to find variety in their time, where they live, where they work, how they make money, different opportunity. I don't know. I definitely know what the negatives. I just think it was inevitable.
Yeah.
I think you just as easily say like, you know, in the pre-digital is like, all right, do you think the fact, I don't know if I'm going to find the right metaphor here, but I mean, would it have been better if everyone lived in 1,000-person tribes and were not able to reach each other via, you know, airplane, horse-drawn carriage, boat or whatnot, right? I mean, you can find the negatives to it, right? To modern society. And trust me, people were not, the criticism of modernity did not begin with the internet. So yeah, I mean, I think, and listen, it's going to evolve. I mean, has Clubhouse caught your eye yet?
No.
Oh, wow. You haven't, no knowledge about Clubhouse whatsoever?
No, please inform.
So Clubhouse is essentially an audio chat social media platform. So people start rooms, people join the room, you can invite people up on stage, everyone chat, discuss, you know, you could have stage, audience, people coming up to the stage, blah, 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 blah. And in your hallway, the app is a hallway where you have all these rooms that you can navigate. And it's taken off and it's been shown so far to be very powerful. People are really like, business leaders, cultural leaders are really gravitating towards it. The person who invited me on, and I got invited on pretty early, was one of the investors who said, this is going to change, Clubhouse is going to change the world. And his views, his explanation, I think will certainly be food for thought for you, given what you've expressed about social media. He said that Clubhouse is going to change the world because it introduces voice into the recipe of social media, in that in hearing people's voices, that then humanizes everyone and creates healthier relationships, healthier interactions. It's not people typing at each other and then getting offended, dunking on each other and yelling at each other.
Right.
And thus far, his thesis has proven out pretty well. I mean, Clubhouse isn't all fucking rainbows and sunshine. There's definitely tense moments, people arguing and whatnot. But you can tell that the exercise of connecting with people voice-wise or chatting with people, like just logging onto your phone and all of a sudden you just talk to and meet a new cool person that could be God knows where and you never would have met in a million years otherwise. I mean, that's a pretty cool experience. And I think a lot of people are finding that to be appealing. And so who knows? I mean, is Clubhouse really going to change the world? Maybe. I think there's initial feedback is really good. So maybe that's it. Maybe the next step in the evolution of social media is allowing the internet allowing people to talk to each other. And that's good. There's a lot of narcissism on Clubhouse, right? Because there's, hey, look at, but if it's, the type of narcissism you saw in your elementary high school classes where some people like to raise their hand more.
Yeah.
Right? So I think this next phase of social audio is super interesting. And we'll see.
No, but that's a good point because I do like, you know, when I get a text or I send like an audio text as opposed to just the numerical text, because even a friend of mine said to me, oh, you're not a text guy. And it's weird. It's not like I'm some curmudgeon old man who refuses to text. Of course I text. But to your point, I like hearing people's voices. You know, I like the energy when I play a show. I certainly prefer the energy of a show and being in the room with 50, 100 people as opposed to doing an IG live. Of course, it's fine, and it's, I'm not saying it's the worst, but I think I'm an energy guy. You know, I remember seeing you two at Staples Center and being in the room. That sure as hell would be a lot different than watching them on a freaking television screen. So
totally. So yeah, we'll see what Clubhouse and social audio does to the factors that you've identified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Matt, I appreciate you taking the time. I'll record like an intro or something beforehand. I'll send you an email if there's like some questions or something I need answered. But this will go live in like about a week or so. But I love
the name, and I love just the exercise of having these discussions, dude. It's super cool. And I'm glad that whatever I've been saying has resonated with you, and I think warranted a really interesting discussion today.
I appreciate it. Likewise.
For sure.
Cool, man. Well, have a great rest of your day. I'll speak to you or email you soon.
Absolutely, man. Thanks so much.
Later, dude. Thanks. Bye.